This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The current moment, not just political, is the most grim moment in human history. We are now in a situation where this generation, in fact, in the next few years, is going to have to make a decision of cosmic significance, which has never arisen before. Will organized human society survive? And there are two enormous threats. The threat of environmental catastrophe, which at least is getting some attention, not enough. The other is the threat of nuclear war, which is increasing sharply by the Trump administration, in fact. These have to be dealt with quickly.
That was Noam Chomsky, recorded by Mehdi Hassan in 2019. We hope humanity will bend away from the looming climate disaster. I try to focus on solar, wind, or electric cars, but in reality, the dominant minority plan to flood the Earth with far more fossil fuels this decade. Countries and corporations are pouring trillions into a new glut of oil and gas, while China and India continue to build even more coal power plants. We talk through a new report from Global Witness, and then the brilliant Daniel Rothman from MIT examines past mass extinctions only to discover a new threshold approaching hidden deep in the ocean. I'm Alex Smith. This is Climate Crisis Radio. From the world of climate suicide, major announcements of new oil and gas discoveries appear almost daily. Iran says they found another 50 billion barrels. Canada is expanding delivery along with Brazil, Russia, and many more. But one country alone promises to drown the world with oil and gas in this decade, the United States of America. The bad news comes from analysis by a respected Norwegian firm. It is reported by the international nonprofit group Global Witness, and it matches all the figures coming from the UN's International Energy Agency, from the American Energy Information Administration, and press releases handed out by major oil and gas corporations. Is this climate nightmare real? We have reached Julianne Miranda Brobeck. She is U.S. Communications Manager for Global Witness. From Washington, D.C., Julianne, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you so much for having us on your show.
Well, I thought Global Witness was more of a human rights group getting real information out of difficult places. How did this report on growing fossil fuel supplies come about?
So Global Witness has been investigating corruption, human rights, and environmental abuses for the past 25 years. And we have campaigned tirelessly and endlessly to end both environmental and human rights abuses driven by the exploitation of natural resources. So in the face of this escalating climate crisis, it was only natural progression for us to start looking at how the exploitation of oil and gas is driving unprecedented environmental devastation around the world.
And your group's report is titled, The U.S. is Set to Drown the World with Oil. It was released last summer, and this is not about some time in the distant future, but the coming decade from 2020 to 2029. And this report is only about new production. I thought we were sort of doomed to warming well beyond 2 degrees C if we burn the fossil fuels we already have. What do you think?
The report title that you just mentioned does sound a bit hyperbolic, but it's actually very accurate. And in terms of current oil production, the short answer to your question is no. So that is if you're looking at fossil fuel projects that are already producing. They are not expected to put us beyond the 2 degrees warming Celsius. The issue is actually a lot more complex than that, and there are many factors that contribute to warming, with fossil fuels, of course, being the biggest culprit. So our investigation and analysis is looking at current production in order to show a fuller picture. So our analysis assumes that current production over the next decade, as I mentioned, will not put us over 1.5 degrees warming, and that's the figure that we should really be looking at. Many speak about 2 degrees, but climate experts say that we should actually be aiming for 1.5 degrees. So our analysis assumes that current production over the next decade will not put us over the 1.5 degrees warming. And again, that is a figure that climate experts around the world are using instead of the 2 degrees, which would just be too much and put us way over climate catastrophe. So if we're looking at existing fields and if investments in these fields continue as is, we are not projected to go above the 1.5 degree warming. However, the real issue is new oil and gas production, which is what our report looks at. Any production from new oil and gas fields, which is what much of these fossil fuel companies are already counting on as part of their reserves, any new production will put us over this 1.5 degrees warming. And the biggest driver behind this new production is one country alone. It's the United States.
And talk to us about the disproportionate boom in the new American oil and gas production compared to other well-known fossil fuel suppliers.
Yeah, so this really is a story of the U.S. fracking boom following the development of new techniques in the 1990s that made it possible to reach previously inaccessible gas deposits buried deep under shale rock. And we're seeing this across the country as we speak. In our new report, we show how 61% of all new oil and gas in the world will come from the U.S. And to put this into perspective, that is 8 times more than Canada, who is projected to be the next largest producer, 20 times that of Russia, and 40 times that of Saudi Arabia. And those figures are all referencing production from new fields. Speaking in current terms, new U.S. production will be 2 times that of what Saudi Arabia is currently producing.
And so where is the new American oil and gas expected to come from? What parts of the country?
Quite interesting, but it may not come as a surprise. Texas is projected to be the biggest producer of new oil and gas. And this is especially due to new finds in the Permian Basin. Pennsylvania is the second largest U.S. new oil and gas producer. And in fact, if you compare new production across the world, and if you treat U.S. states as countries in this case, then 7 out of the top 10 new producers around the world would be U.S. states. And this is quite staggering and alarming. Some other stats that we have showed in our analysis is that Pennsylvania will be producing 2 times that of Russia, and 25% of all new production will come from one state alone, and that is Texas. Quite alarmingly, a lot of the effects of climate change, which will only be exacerbated by this new production, will disproportionately affect lower-income communities and communities of color. There was one study that came out showing that something like 90% of inhabitants living in a one mile radius of large oil and gas plants are communities of color. This means that they are most exposed to toxins in the air and any contaminants that leach into water supply, and it's just absolutely unacceptable.
You know, some energy experts question the whole scenario, but let's leave that for a moment. First, we need to know, where did your team get the production and reserve numbers in your report?
That's a great question. For our analysis, we use data from Rystad Energy, and you know, they're renowned and trusted industry analysts. And we compared this data against the latest climate scenarios presented in the IPCC report, so that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the world's leading authority on climate science. And their report came out at the end of last year.
Is it really possible that America will far surpass Saudi Arabia in production?
Yeah, in fact, that's already happened. It's quite alarming. And that comparison with Saudi Arabia and the U.S. is quite an interesting one, especially right now, given everything that's happening on the world stage. And traditionally, Saudi Arabia has been one of the largest oil producers, with Russia also in the top three. But currently, the U.S. is actually on the top, making up 18% of production, according to some analyses. And, you know, our report alarmingly shows that the U.S. will skyrocket from this 18%. And, you know, with its new oil and gas production, they're set up to make up 61% of all new production in the next decade. And this is increasing overall production by 25%. And again, that's 20 times that of Russia and 40 times that of Saudi Arabia's new production.
The American government is a real booster of all this. The Energy Information Administration, the EIA, is famous for bullish predictions. But their outlook for coal production fell flat, and there were bankruptcies and insolvencies. And now Canadian geologist David Hughes is questioning the future of the whole fracking model. He says trillions in new investments still cannot maintain that kind of production, and his reality calls the EIA projections crazy. Do you expect the American boom of oil and gas production to really materialize over the next 10 years, or could be there other difficulties that we didn't foresee?
You know, most analysts acknowledge a U.S. shale bubble, and it's only a matter of time when it will burst, yet it keeps going. The question is, will that financial bubble burst in time to save us from this horrific climate catastrophe that we face?
And it sounds like the peak oil movement will have to go back to sleep for another 10 years. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, our analysis and that of others in the field clearly show that any new production is incompatible with the world's climate goals. Urgent action in the U.S. is needed to reverse this trajectory. The current administration has made its energy dominance agenda really clear. And in fact, in the past few months, President Trump made two appearances in Pennsylvania, supporting the oil and gas industry there. It's a clear priority for him and his administration, and we really will need political will to curb any new U.S. oil and gas production, which, as our analysis shows, will just push us over the edge. Federal fossil fuel subsidies cost taxpayers at least $4.6 billion a year, and in fact, there's some analyses that show that this number could actually be $500 billion a year, which is just massive. And half of new U.S. oil fields rely on these government subsidies to be economically viable. This isn't sustainable at all. And this money could be invested elsewhere instead of contributing to reliance on fossil fuels and continuing to warm up our planet.
So, Julianne, Australia is currently the world's largest coal exporter, with even larger mega plans on their drawing boards for new mines. But your report doesn't cover coal?
You're right. So our report is mostly focused on oil and gas. And in our other investigative work and reporting, we've seen that coal is already dying off in many parts of the world as it's simply not economically viable and obviously heavily polluting. And while there's much more work to be done, the big fight looming is over the future of oil and gas, which is why this specific report is focusing on oil and gas.
Why did Global Witness call for the UK and Scotland to stop exploring for more fossil fuels? What is going on there?
So to avoid the worst of this climate catastrophe, we really can't afford to drill and burn any new oil and gas reserves, which means that countries need to stop exploring for more fossil fuels. The UK is a major fossil fuel extractor, and developed nations need to move first in ending fossil fuel production. We can't expect other nations to move if we aren't willing to move first. Quite a few countries have moved to end fossil fuel extraction in their territory already. You can just look at France, Costa Rica, New Zealand, and Belize, and more are on the way. As bigger and better extractors say they will end extraction, it creates a new global climate norm, and we do hope that other countries follow suit. Just as some background information on the UK, as we have several campaigners that are focusing on oil and gas in the UK. The UK has an estimated 5.7 billion barrels of oil and gas reserves in already operating fields. And if we extract those, we will not hit our Paris Climate Agreement quota. And the UK also has an estimated additional 20 billion barrels of oil and gas reserves in the UK strata. And the UK government has legislation which commits them to maximize the economic recovery of these assets, which means take it all out of the ground. But in order to achieve this, we're essentially subsidizing these oil and gas companies. And our analysis shows that in the last 2 out of the 3 years, the UK has paid out more in subsidies to oil and gas companies than they have paid in UK taxes. So therefore, taxpayer money is subsidizing climate change-causing energy sources and the companies that extract and ultimately profit from them. So Global Witness is calling for the UK to commit to a managed phasing out of fossil fuels and to shift subsidies from oil and gas to support a just transition focused on renewable energy and energy efficiency industries. So there's quite a lot of work ahead of us.
It's mind-blowing to think that the fossil fuel industry is really a kind of socialized, state-funded adventure when you get down to the bottom line of it.
Yes, that's very true. And it's also a huge issue here in the U.S., as I mentioned previously. Estimates show that the fossil fuel industry is getting 4.9 to up to about 500 billion in these subsidies a year. And so they really, a lot of these projects just are not economically viable without these subsidies. I previously was referencing President Trump's trip to Pennsylvania earlier in August. He went to visit the Shell petrochemical plant. And we did some data crunching and analysis to show that just looking more closely at the subsidies that make that plant viable, Shell got a $1.65 billion tax break for that plant. And we have the president going there and, you know, touting these industry jobs that we're bringing back to the country. And if you look at this massive tax break, this $1.65 billion, and you break it down, that's about, it's just over $2 million per job created. So that's pretty costly for jobs. So there are estimated to be about 600 permanent jobs that will be created because of this plant, and each of them is backed up by $2 million in subsidies.
But you have to wonder, if the new forecasts for a glut of oil production become reality, won't oil and gas prices crash, thus cutting off or endangering further investment?
You know, to limit climate change, oil demand needs to fall dramatically. And that's both production and consumption need to fall in tandem. So this will really require a huge shift in global transportation, heating, and power generation. But, you know, work on this must start immediately.
This is EcoShock Radio. All environment, all the time. Get more info on the web at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Julianne Miranda Brobeck from Global Witness. And we asked the question, will America flood the world with new oil and gas and thus endanger the climate? And it is hard to imagine a market so flooded with oil and gas. Maybe we'll go back to 15 cents a gallon at the pumps. Everybody can drive SUVs or personal tanks or whatever. It sounds like great news for the consumer and the economy. What is the real problem?
One would think. So growing oil and gas production has enormous and immediate consequences on all of us and on our economy. That really depends on a stable climate. We're already seeing a rise in natural disasters like wildfires, floods, hurricanes, all driven by climate change and worsened by climate change. And all of this has a human toll and a huge economic impact as well. And for this reason, the public is increasingly supporting transitioning to renewable energy and finding solutions to alleviate the climate crisis and its effects. Polls have shown that swing voters and conservatives want politicians to find solutions as they're becoming increasingly concerned about climate change. And that's something that was not the case even 4 years ago. So climate change is featuring prominently across the current presidential debates as well.
According to an article in the Guardian newspaper, the top 50 fossil fuel companies will dump another 225 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere by 2030. And about 35% of that comes from just two companies, ExxonMobil and Shell. And these companies plan to profit by creating an unstoppable climate disaster, it sounds like. And that's okay with politicians and everybody who drives a car, or maybe including me, I guess. It's so hard to see how we can unravel that.
Yes, I completely agree with that. It's incredibly alarming. And a lot of our investigative work also centers around those two companies as well. And even with 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, this will have a huge and dramatic impact on human societies around the world. And above these impacts, they will become severe, widespread, and harder to predict. At the same time, these companies are planning to spend $5 trillion on producing new oil and gas that would drive us further and further above that level of climate impact. Another report that we put out earlier this year was looking at just the scale of that massive investment. So the figure is, I said $5 trillion, it's actually $4.9 trillion, so almost at the $5 trillion mark. And the companies that are really pushing ahead with this kind of crazy investment are Exxon and Shell. They're the top two companies pushing ahead with this. Exxon's leading the pack.
And in the background of all that are the biggest banks and our own pension plans, which are often investing in oil and gas. And I'm hoping that the disinvestment movement, where, for example, universities are saying they will no longer put their saved monies into oil and gas, maybe that can at least slow down this juggernaut. We'll see.
Exactly. And, you know, that movement is certainly gaining steam, and hopefully more investment firms and banks will actually sign on to this. And, you know, again, going back to that figure of the oil and gas industry investing $4.9 trillion into new oil and gas fields in the next decade, it's really also up to investors here to challenge these companies to ensure that their business plans are compatible with the Paris Climate Agreement.
And on the other hand, right now, U.S. government regulatory agencies are openly staffed with former oil and gas lobbyists, with investors and campaign donors. And these agencies work with industry to increase production, not to limit it to save the climate. What can be done?
Yeah, you know, the conflicts of interest across this administration remain a huge problem, whether it's the revolving door with energy companies, giving contracts to former employers, or having a former oil and coal lobbyist heading the Department of Interior and the Environmental Protection Agency. Earlier this year, we uncovered a massive conflict of interest within the Department of Interior. A senior advisor there at the time, Susan Combs, she was leading their effort to relocate the Bureau of Land Management, which is part of the Department of Interior. And we found that companies that were publicly supporting this relocation out of Washington, D.C., you know, they were publicly saying that this would eliminate red tape and, you know, decrease burden on them. And it turns out that Susan Combs also owns a ranch in Texas, and she's leasing out her land to these same oil and gas companies that were supporting her efforts to relocate the Bureau of Land Management. And that's just a massive conflict of interest. She's being paid by these companies who are supporting a very controversial move that she was spearheading. And we really need to improve conflicts of interest rules in this country to ensure officials work in the public interest, not in their own private interest or in corporate interest. And here, our futures really are at stake.
So do you think this little problem of our planned suicide with fossil fuels will become more important in the 2020 U.S. elections?
We certainly hope so. And, you know, this fall, we saw it gaining much more momentum. There were designated climate debates on CNN and MSNBC in collaboration with Georgetown University. And that was fantastic. Many groups, including us, were pushing for the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, to also hold a designated climate debate. And unfortunately, they did not vote for that resolution. But then, you know, these media companies and universities have taken up that fight, and they're hosting and these kinds of debates and also giving a platform for more attention to be focused on these issues. Voters across the board are increasingly concerned about this issue, and it will certainly continue to be an important issue ahead of the election.
And I wonder if America becomes the next Saudi Arabia, with Texas the decider in a lot of policy and national affairs, is that going to be a good thing even for America?
Well, so if the question is, will oil interests come to control U.S. politics? We see many instances of this in the current administration. It's already happening, and it's very alarming. We can only work to expose this and ensure that it does not get worse in the current political landscape that we find ourselves in. We need to continue to push to strengthen conflicts of interest laws and rules in this country and to curb the influence of money on our political decision making. From our experience investigating oil corruption all around the world, we know the sad fate of countries that are completely captured by oil interests. And we, of course, do not want the United States to be the next one of those.
Julianne, tell us what Global Witness is and how we can follow your reports and investigations.
Global Witness is an international organization that has worked tirelessly to fight for a more just and sustainable planet. Our investigations expose corruption, human rights, and environmental abuses around the world. You can learn more about our work at www.globalwitness.org.
We have been speaking with Julianne Miranda Brobeck, U.S. Global Communications Manager for the international group Global Witness, and you can find their excellent reports and blogs at globalwitness.org. I've spent some time there. I will add a few links to my own show blog at ecoshock.org. You can look there for connections to this story. Julianne, thank you for bearing witness to this fossil fuel madness.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been a great conversation, and we really appreciate all the reporting you do.
I have to disagree with one response from our guest, Julianne Miranda Brobeck. She said, "Our analysis assumes that current production over the next decade will not put us over the 1.5 degrees C warming." Technically, Julianne is not wrong, because that is what authorities like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change are still saying. But I think there is no carbon budget left. We have already crossed 1.5 degrees warming in many parts of the world, and may have topped it globally once the shield of air pollution is cleaned up. I checked this point with Radio EcoShock guest David Spratt from Australia. David has several articles about this, and I will put those links in my show blog. You should check them out. David sent this quote from American scientist Michael Mann. "We have no carbon budget left for the 1.5 degrees C target, and the opportunity for holding to 2 degrees C is rapidly fading unless the world starts cutting emissions hard right now," end quote from Michael Mann. Our previous guest, Yang-Yang Shu, also warned we would cross 1.5 degrees C by 2030, even with our current emissions, as countries like China succeed in cleaning up air pollution. The point is, we should have slashed greenhouse gas emissions a couple of decades ago, and we have no remaining burn permit if we want a safe planet. The Global Witness Report, called "The U.S. is Set to Drown the World with Oil," was published last summer, so this activist group was way ahead of recent news. The United Nations just released their report in November called "The Production Gap." They say, quote, "Governments are planning to produce about 50% more fossil fuels by 2030 than would be consistent with a 2 degrees C pathway and 120% more than would be consistent with a 1.5 degrees C pathway," end quote. Most countries that can produce fossil fuels plan to make a lot more of them. Canada wants to build more pipelines from their dirty tar sands. Russia is always busy in their exploration. Governments from the UK to Australia are funding their own coming disasters. Oh, Australia, you're burning yourself down. And everybody wants to drill in the Arctic. But we learn from Global Witness that the key is now in America. Their report reveals our fate may depend on new oil and gas coming from the United States over the next decade. If the fracking revolution is allowed to proceed in America alone, we are all toast. That is clear. As a result, the Global Carbon Project just reported emissions hit another record high this year. So we're still going up, still heading towards a climate shift that will test the survival of humanity and all species. Is that interesting? Is it as good as impeachment? Does it matter that we're all in serious, grave danger not seen since Hitler invaded Europe? This is no time to sink into false optimism. This is time to make major changes in our lives, our economy, our way of thinking, and our politics. This is the climate emergency. Stay tuned for more Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
There is a lot of interest in extinction lately. Species from birds to bees are disappearing, and we hope humans are not next. Where are the limits? When is it too late? Daniel Rothman is a professor of geophysics at MIT and co-director of the Lorenz Center. His 2017 paper, "Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System," well, it was a startling new look at the role of carbon in the ocean. Now he's published what I'll call Part 2 with the somewhat obscure title, "Characteristic Disruptions of an Excitable Carbon Cycle." If you're wondering how it all could end, this quiet MIT mathematician and theoretical scientist has a kind of rude warning for us all. We last spoke in November 2017. Daniel Rothman, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, we need to refresh what I'll call your foundational paper for this series, "Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System." Would you mind walking us through how you came to look at records of ancient carbon in the seabed and what you consider the role of the ocean and the atmosphere to be?
Sure. The study began quite literally with a couple of simple observations. The observations, which I think many people are broadly familiar with, there are on the order of five, the so-called Big Five mass extinctions that are sort of well ingrained in the public consciousness now, such as the end Cretaceous and the end Permian extinction. And each of these major extinction events are accompanied by a significant change in the carbon cycle, which we can see in the rock record. On the other hand, there are many events, so-called paleoclimate events, in which we can see roughly similar changes in the carbon cycle, but there is no major extinction. And so I basically was curious about whether this idea of roughly similar could be quantified, because it wasn't obvious that they were indeed similar and that there might be a difference. And so I asked myself whether there was some difference between the kinds of perturbations that we that sort of have often occurred in the geologic past and the ones that are somehow special, meaning that they're especially destructive or catastrophic, such as mass extinction. And that's the sort of basic question, but there's another component to this, and that has to do with what's going on today. And it's well known that the CO2 is being effectively injected into the atmosphere now at unprecedented rates, and a large portion of that is going into the oceans. And so the rate is very fast, much faster than anything we've seen in the past, including past mass extinctions. But it's not a priori obvious that the rate at which things change is the particular variable that we should be addressing. And so I wanted to know of what could be said about that. And the specific issue enters the 2017 paper, but the one I addressed in much more detail in the most recent paper is how to look at these past events, which occur at timescales of tens of thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of years, how they become relevant, or if they are relevant at all, to understanding what's going on now at a timescale of effectively 100 years, meaning the timescale of industrial emissions.
And you made a model that kind of stretches in two different directions, whether it's the rate of carbon getting in there or the amount of time it takes it to get there. But to do those calculations, you first need to kind of picture, and we all need to picture, a kind of trade-off in carbon between the atmosphere and storage in the oceans. There's a sort of balanced loop. Do you want to talk about how that works? I mean, some flows out of the rivers and some goes into the seabed and some goes back. How does it work?
So you're asking about the carbon cycle in general, I suppose. The carbon cycle is, on the one hand, a delightfully simple beast, even though it's very complex and when you get into the details. And it's this loop you speak of is just a loop between photosynthesis, which takes CO2 out of the atmosphere, or in the case of marine plankton, out of seawater. And that's what we call primary production. And the back end of the loop, or the back reaction, is what we call respiration. That is, organisms like us, which metabolize the organic matter, which ultimately derives from plants or from organisms that consume the plants. And these organisms, known as consumer organisms, basically metabolize the organic carbon and bring it back to CO2 by an oxidation process. So it's a loop between taking CO2 out of the atmosphere by plants and returning CO2 to the atmosphere by consuming organisms. Many of these organisms are not necessarily animals like us. They're just microbial. And the microbial organisms can become especially interesting in the oceans because they not only operate at very fast timescales near the sea surface, but they operate at very slow timescales near the sea bottom.
And your studies show that this system tends to be stable in the ocean for long periods of time, if I understand it.
Well, yes. I mean, it's sort of commonly assumed that it more or less is stable. That's not necessarily based on any evidence that is solid, but a feeling that it goes back to the ancient notion of nature being in balance. And so if nature is in balance, then the system must be stable. Otherwise, why would it be balanced, right? That's the naive statement. And so yes, it's sort of stable, and indeed, if you now look at the geologic record of changes in the carbon cycle, what you see is that it does go through long periods of stability. But what interests me, and was of interest in when I wrote those papers, is the fact that these long periods of stability are punctuated by relatively short periods of basically some type of perturbation, some type, we call them events, and the events bring the system away from its typical state, and then it returns back to its typical state. And so there's a physical slash mathematical question one can ask as to whether those events are the result of an instability. And the instability is, if you wish, I mean, one of my favorite examples of an unstable process would be a lawnmower that runs on grass. All right, it just sort of goes out of control because it makes it run even faster. But that's a question that ultimately one needs to, with respect to the carbon cycle or any system, one needs to examine carefully. And just because there's a positive feedback in the system, so to give you an example of a positive feedback that many people are familiar with would be permafrost or peat. As the climate warms, more organic matter is remineralized in the thawing permafrost, and that raises CO2 levels even higher, which then feeds back positively into the system. That's scary by itself. However, it doesn't necessarily establish that the system is unstable, because we don't know what we have to evaluate what the negative feedbacks are to the process too. And so this is where the importance of mathematical models comes in, because with mathematical models you can write down a kind of idealization of the process and ask questions of, given these feedbacks, when, if at all, does it become unstable?
Right. It sounds like it's almost a system where once it begins to wobble, it may resettle into a stable state, or it may just fall over. And maybe you could talk to us about what you mean by an excitable carbon cycle in the new paper.
Thanks for asking. So I divided the world up into two a moment ago, stable and unstable. Right? Excitable is actually somewhere in the middle. And an excitable system works in the following way. If you push it a little bit beyond a threshold, then it acts as if it's becoming unstable. So it makes, basically, it fires what we call a kind of spike. That is, there's a major change, a major perturbation in the system. But then it returns back to its point of stability all by itself. So from a technical or physical point of view, the system is always stable because the same initial state is returned after it goes through this so-called, if you wish, an excursion into another territory. In the case of the carbon cycle, it's ocean acidification. After the ocean acidifies, then it returns to its previous state. And so technically it turns out to be stable, even though it goes through this excitation. And for some of your listeners, the following analogy may be of interest. Excitable systems were first studied in the mid-20th century by biophysicists who are interested in how neurons work. So if you inject a sufficiently strong current into a neuron, then it fires what's called a neuron spike. But if it's not strong enough, it doesn't fire a spike. And that's how neurons work, and this has been a well-studied phenomenon since the mid-20th century. It's developed into an entire sort of sub-discipline of biophysics and applied mathematics. And my paper falls within that tradition. The models are different. They come from a different place, but they exhibit a range of behavior that falls within that class.
The most famous mass death event in the past 500 million years was the end-Permian extinction around 250 million years ago. Did you find any sort of evidence that that could have been the kind of excursion that you're talking about?
That's a very interesting question. So here's how it plays out. I made a database. We live in an age of big data. Big data in this subject means 31 events. All right, so you can put them all on a table on one page of a journal, but it's a lot of work, finding all of that. So there's 31 events, roughly. I mean, that's exactly what I studied, which are global, perturbations, if you wish, of the carbon cycle during the last 540 million years. Right. Now, of those 31 events, roughly half of them plot out, and when you plot them as a function of the size, that is the extent of the perturbation versus the time scale at which they occur, what you see is that they exhibit a characteristic flux of carbon being mobilized in the system. And when I say characteristic flux, you know, today we're putting in like 8 or 9 gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere. This is a much slower characteristic flux, but it's basically gigatons of CO2 being remobilized into the system per unit time. So the question is, what makes these special? Why are there half of the events just lining up in this one sort of special way? And so that accounts for the obscure title of the paper you just referred to as the characteristic events. That's what I call them. They're characteristic events, and I refer to them as characteristic because they have the signature of an excitation. That is a characteristic excitation. It is a They have the signature of the system itself rather than a mechanism that's making things change. There's no way to sensibly attribute them to methane or volcanism or changes in whatever you wish to invoke, because they're all behaving in the same way. So why would they be subject to different types of stressors? So, but the question you asked is about the end Permian extinction. That's the worst of them all. You know, greater than 90% of species are thought to have died. And when you look at that carbon cycle event, that's way larger than all of the others. And when I say larger, I mean its flux is stronger. It has a flux of CO2, which is about 5 times the characteristic flux that I was referring to earlier. And so what is that? So my best guess at the moment, following the reasoning I've been recounting in the past few minutes, I would say that these are excitations that have been pushed way beyond their threshold. And the likely culprit is volcanism in Siberia, known as Siberian Trap Volcanism. And that raises an entirely other question is about the role of volcanism in mass extinctions.
But what you said just a minute ago was kind of exciting to me because it causes us to make a real rethink. Instead of thinking about the ocean as a passive recorder that just mirrors back what's happened in major geo events, whether it's volcanoes or an asteroid hitting or something, you're saying, no, wait a minute, this is a system that within itself can make big changes that could affect the whole process of the Earth.
Right. You hit that nail on its head. That's exactly what's going on. That's one of the more important points that I was trying to make. As the system contains enough complexity of its own to engage in these abrupt events. And so the role of a theoretical paper like mine is to show how that could occur. And because it's mathematical theory, it doesn't really pin down a precise mechanism. It basically provides examples of how such a thing would behave, and then it makes comparisons to observational data to show that, indeed, the observational data is consistent with the theory.
But as you said, about half the cases of warming that you find in the big record, it gets a lot hotter, and things don't go extinct. And,
that's right.
I'm thinking about the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum,
exactly.
55 million years ago.
Yeah, that's the poster child here. Absolutely. It's a very significant paleoclimate event. It's a very significant ocean acidification event. And there are some species of benthic foraminifera, little critters that live at the bottom of the sea that went extinct. But it's nothing like the so-called Big Five.
Okay, now, here's the key question. I feel like I'm asking my doctor whether I have cancer or not. How can we know? How can we know if the current rush towards a hotter world will be a time of mass extinction or not?
Yeah, and then the doctor looks at you and he says, "We don't know." So I tried to address this question in my paper, and basically my goal was to develop a rational framework in which to address the issue, and the framework looks like this. It is indeed the case that there seems to be a kind of critical rate, but the critical rate of change beyond which things go haywire. That critical rate of change is the characteristic rate I was speaking of earlier, and that's a typical excitation. And so the issue is, how much does it take to get to that point? At least that's what I was trying to address. Not so much how much does it take to get over it, but how much does it take to get to it? And so there's this notion of excitation that I was referring to earlier. You need to get beyond a threshold. And the threshold can be cast as a kind of critical flux of carbon that's required to put into the system. And so the bottom line is this. If the event is playing out over a slow time scale, that critical flux is not very large. But if it's playing out over a fast time scale, that critical flux is very large. And indeed, the critical flux scales, this is now me speaking mathematically, it scales like 1 over the time scale. And that basically says the following, and this is a result in the paper which I'm quite pleased with. If you go to the extinction that killed the dinosaurs, there's very recent results that lead to an estimate of the amount of CO2 that was injected into the atmosphere, not by the bolide impact in Yucatan, which is now widely familiar to people, but by the Deccan Trap volcanism in India, which also occurred at the same time. So setting aside the question of what caused the extinction, the volcanism, you know, and or the bolide impact, we have an estimate of how much CO2 was added just before, when I say just before, order 10,000 years before the KT and Cretaceous extinction. And so that turns out that the flux of that is sort of 100 times less strong than the flux of CO2 into the atmosphere today. That's a factor of 100 smaller. So that seems minuscule compared to what's going on today. Or you might think that what's going on today is absolutely enormous compared to what went on then. On the other hand, today's perturbation of the system is going on over 100 years as opposed to 10,000 years. So there's that factor of 100 again. And because the time scale is 100 times shorter, but the flux is 100 times greater, they turn out to cancel each other. So today's flux, today's, you know, basically anthropogenic flux, turns out to be roughly equivalent to the flux of CO2 that was observed, you know, just before the Cretaceous extinction, but equivalent in the sense of being able to get over a threshold that will excite the system. And so that, to me, was a nice comparison because it shows how the present-day emissions can be effectively rescaled to put them in the perspective of the past, or vice versa, which is actually what would interest most people, how we can interpret the past so it becomes relevant to the present.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about a limit to our carbon pollution hidden in the ocean. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Rothman from MIT. So, through your calculations, you were able to arrive at approximately the amount of carbon that we could still stick up there in the atmosphere before we reach this threshold, and maybe even a date when the threshold would be reached at our current rate. Do you want to talk about that, please?
Sure. It's basically several hundred gigatons of CO2 going into the oceans. Let's call it 300 to 400 as a round number, given some reasonable error bar. And when currently human activities have put in on the order of 150 gigatons of carbon into the ocean, so about twice that. And that level, by any reasonable estimate, will be reached sometime this century, right? And beyond that, that's, you know, given the analysis of the empirical record and given our understanding that we've developed of how the system works, that's the amount of CO2 that, when added to the oceans, risks exciting one of these ocean acidification events, and ocean acidification being a likely kill mechanism for major extinctions in the past. Now, there's an important caveat to this. All of this is about the oceans, and which is also where our record of past extinctions primarily lies, and it's also where our database lies in ocean bottom sediments. But events in the ocean play out at slow time scales. And by that I mean is that the oceans have a natural damping time scale of about 10,000 years. So if we acidify the oceans today, that acidification pulse, if you could instantaneously acidify the oceans, that would basically be neutralized after about 10,000 years. So what that means physically is that anything we do, that is, if we perturb the system beyond what I'm calling the excitation threshold, the runaway effect that that would excite would play out over that damping time scale about 10,000 years before it is basically neutralized. And so it's not that, you know, one day we go over the limit and the next day everything is over. It's a process. And what happens during those 10,000 years is kind of unknown. I mean, my work has tried to address some of it, but it leaves many questions unanswered.
Of course, my human bias, I'm going to say, well, if it takes another 10,000 years, we may be on another planet by then, or we may have killed ourselves off with something else like nuclear weapons. I mean,
yeah. Well, the first 100 won't be nice.
Okay, so we could feel some effects pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, when you back away from this work, what you see is that my analysis is, in a sense, not coming to a terribly different conclusion than a lot of very different analyses are coming to. That beyond a certain amount, there's a lot of unpredictable things that might happen. And by examining the ancient record, I'm trying to figure out what that amount is, you know, given these rescaling factors that I talked about. And it's kind of interesting that it doesn't turn out to be a whole lot different than, you know, a whole lot of other calculations about, you know, when the various tipping points might kick in. And that's, you know, in the popular parlance, that what we're talking about here is a kind of tipping point phenomenon.
But you're looking not really at temperature that's going to burn us out. You're looking at ocean acidification. So that's a whole other aspect.
Yeah, which is not going to be helped by the weather becoming warmer.
No.
Becoming warmer at all. But that's right. I'm looking at purely the consequences of adding CO2 to the oceans.
And it occurs to me that your theory can blow up one of the key arguments for cooling the planet with geoengineering, because proponents say, well, we'll shoot some sulfates into the air, it'll reflect some sun, it'll cool things off while we figure out something else, we'll keep burning fossil fuels. But your research says temperature isn't the key anyway, because if you keep adding all that carbon to the ocean, you still go into a possible disastrous mass extinction eventually.
That's about 99% correct. I would just disagree with temperature isn't the key anyway. What I'm saying is CO2, as you just observed, is very important. So is temperature. The larger point is this. By making the types of perturbations that we are, you know, collectively are doing today, that is, you know, injecting a lot of CO2 into the system, we're not just changing the climate. We're doing many, many other things, and these things have consequences. That it's so basically what I'm trying to say is warming isn't the only thing going on here, and effects on ecosystems are obviously a big piece of the puzzle.
Is there any sign that people like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or other policy people are starting to pick up on your paper and add this to our reasons why we've got to get going now?
You know, those kinds of questions are hard to answer. All right? You know, I feel like a well-recognized scientist, so I'm not going to tell you that nobody's paying any attention. But also, like a lot of well-recognized scientists, I also feel that I could probably do with a little bit more recognition. So I don't really know how to address that, other than to say I think it's inevitable that organizations like the IPCC will start paying more attention to what was once called the unknown unknowns, all right, than things like climate sensitivity, which is something that's relatively easy to address.
Well, I think people like the Extinction Rebellion movement should pay attention to this too, because it's a bigger part of their story. So are you going to keep going with this line of research with more papers to come?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, there's these 31 events to explain. I've taken some very gross view of them. Those events in the deep past, which are even greater, which have to do with, for example, the oxygenation of the atmosphere, or the possibility that the whole Earth froze over. The whole Earth freezing over doesn't seem like a warming event, but it may be associated with warming events that occurred before such episodes. I'm referring to the so-called snowball Earth events. And then there are these garden variety paleoclimate events, which I referred to earlier, and a whole bunch of them occur in a period known as the Eocene, the one that followed the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum that you referred to earlier. And they're a very nice place to look because they all have this characteristic type of behavior, but it's not really clear what's really making that system go. To make it concrete, I've provided a theory of how an excitable carbon cycle could work, but I haven't pinned down what the mechanism of getting over the threshold is, and that would be of a lot of interest.
Daniel, as we wrap up, just out of curiosity, what else are you working on these days?
Oh, a variety of things. I've spent several decades now, three, working on problems of fluid mechanics, which are very different, in which I study pattern formation and on geological problems, for instance, the shape of rivers. That's a major component of my work. But I also maybe should point back to something I just mentioned a moment ago, something that's going to occupy a lot of my attention in the coming few years, is to, trying to explain why the atmosphere has the oxygen that it has. And this will amount to explaining what we call the great oxygenation event, which occurred about 2.5 billion years ago. Somehow oxygen accumulated, and the way it accumulated and the way it stayed in the atmosphere has something to do with some imperfections in that loop of the carbon cycle we just talked about earlier. So it's kind of curious why these are effectively feedback errors, and the feedback errors, this is a whole other subject, but the feedback errors are responsible for why there's a bunch of free oxygen in the atmosphere, and I'd like to figure out how that works.
It would be handy to know why it is we can breathe or why
exactly.
We even exist as multicellular organisms. So that's all handy. We've been speaking with MIT Professor Daniel Rothman, and you can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Daniel, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you, and come back again.
Thanks very much, Alex. I've enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.
A scientist tells people the truth. When times are good, when the truth offers no threat, people don't mind. But when times are very, very bad, well, a magician tells people what they wish were true.